Welcome to Island Issues, our public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to the very final Island Issues here on Lava 105 in Koa Country. Today, I promised you a continuation of our discussion with Dr. Drew Harvell, a biologist from Cornell University. Part one aired last Sunday, and that was actually our interview from 2016. Today, we will get the 2019 update from Dr. Harvell, who continues her work here on the Big Island. But we get a bonus. Hawaiian Volcano Observatory just published a brand new map showing the thickness of the brand new 2018 summer lava flow, and it's kind of interesting. So I was able last Thursday to talk with Frank Truesdale, a geologist at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, about this preliminary map. And at the end of my discussion with Dr. Harvell, I will share a portion of the discussion I had with Frank. First, Dr. Drew Harvell, who along with students have been working here on the Big Island with Kohala Center on ocean health issues and doing similar work on the mainland. Let's get to that discussion. Dr. Harvell, thank you so much for being with us again.
Aloha, Sherry. I appreciate being here.
Dr. Harvell, when we spoke last at the beginning of 2016, you were working with the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health on a series of initiatives called Ecology and Evolution of Infectious Diseases. And that, as I recall, had to do with spreading infectious diseases via warm water. And of course, we live on an island that has pretty warm water surrounding it. So give us the status of that project, if you will.
Our research coordination network brings together a team of roughly 40 scientists that meet annually to discuss some of the pressing epidemics we have in the ocean and try to understand how these diseases are transmitted, what are the causative microbial agents, and of course, what is the role of a warming ocean? And since we've had pretty hot waters, 2015, 16, and 17, it's been a time when it's been really important for the group to work together to investigate these spreading diseases in starfish, corals, and things like abalone. And of course, we've also, with coral reefs, there's been a huge bleaching event, which is then followed by epidemics of infectious disease. So the group has had its work cut out for it. It's been pretty key, though, to bring these scientists together to work collaboratively on investigating these outbreaks.
That sort of brings me back to the first time I had the nice opportunity to talk with you at the beginning of 2016. We had just gone through the really warm water of 2015. Coral was bleaching, and you were doing some work in Puako with the coral and the reefs. Give us a sense as to where Puako is now relative to its corals and the health of the reef.
Yeah, we bring a team of scientists and our students from Cornell University to monitor reefs in places like Puako. That's been one of our main study sites. 2015 was an incredibly grim year. It was really tough to see the level of mortality and the loss of live coral cover on those reefs and in many of the sites that we visited around the Big Island. Last year was really encouraging in that we saw about a 15 to 18% increase in live coral cover. So we feel this year that we may even be able to catch increased improvement in coral cover and some degree of recovery.
I know in Puako, one of the issues was sewage going into the water. Any sense as to when that problem gets solved, whether the reefs can return to a better state?
Well, of course, when our coral reefs are under so much climate stress, we want to do everything we can to improve the resilience of those reefs. And sewage is definitely a menace that can also cause corals to be diseased and die. Last year, we did study levels of bacteria on the Puako reef, and we found a very clear signal that with rainfall events, the bacteria skyrocketed and went to much higher levels. We don't have all the data in for that, but we do know that the Enterococcus bacteria went to very high levels following rainfall events. and we're sequencing all the species of bacteria that were there, and it will be interesting to see what kinds of pathogens we might find in the water.
Why would rainfall events increase the bacteria in the water?
Well, the land here, especially in a place like Pulco, is very porous. The volcanic rock is just loaded with fissures and channels, and so whatever pollutants are on shore are very rapidly conveyed to our reefs, and we certainly find that right away at Pulco. And so with rainfall events, the cesspools that line the shore there basically overflow and go right to the reef.
As you know, probably the State Department of Health has mandated that we get rid of cesspools on the Big Island, and clearly that's one reason why, although there's a lot of discussion about what to replace them with and how to do that, because the solution isn't quite clear.
Yeah, I'm really delighted that this is a move that's being instituted across the Big Island, across Hawaii, really. It's desperately needed. It's tough. I mean, it's an economic issue to figure out how to fix this, but it's absolutely vital for these marine resources with growing populations and with the stress of climate change.
Dr. Drew Harvell, you have written a book called Ocean Outbreak. Tell us a little bit about this book. What's it all about?
Oh, well, thank you for asking, Sherry. I wrote Ocean Outbreak because there's a large unseen body count under the ocean's waves. We're finding escalating epidemics of sea urchins, sea stars, abalone, the fish we eat like salmon, and really a whole host of marine organisms are affected by disease outbreaks, which in many cases are worse with climate warming. So the book is kind of bringing to light the dynamics of these epidemics and the people that work on them, and the kinds of solutions that we're hoping to come up with and develop for particular outbreaks. For example, you know, scientists are really good at dealing with human disease. There's incredible technology for figuring out the microbes and coming up with vaccines and solutions. There's so much less known about the actual microorganisms that cause disease, that are infectious among ocean critters, and the impacts of these, and we're so far from many solutions. It's time to actually muster our scientific resources and study these better and come up with solutions. And you know, there really are solutions. Some of the work we've done in Indonesia has shown that pathogens are reduced by half by nature's services, for example, in seagrass beds, and that coral health is much better in those kinds of environments. And so that's kind of one very small example of something that can be done in terms of improving the resilience of our marine resources.
Now, is that because the seagrass beds clean the water in some way? Why do the seagrass beds help the health of the ocean?
Well, we think there are three mechanisms, three processes at work in seagrass beds. For one thing, all sewage treatment plants use oxygen because a lot of bacteria are what we call anaerobic. They die when there's oxygen. So seagrass beds are very, very good at producing an awful lot of oxygen. So that alone is probably one of the major killers of some of these pathogenic bacteria in the water. There's also a lot of biodiversity housed in a seagrass bed, and things like clams, mussels, and oysters, and sponges are constantly filtering the water and probably doing a lot of the cleanup work within the seagrass bed. Finally, we're sort of getting to smaller and smaller things, but there are microorganisms, the microbiome, that lives on the surface of the seagrass blades that itself can kill other kinds of bacteria, that produces its own kinds of antibiotics that can regulate its bacterial environment. So just to summarize, we think there's at least three mechanisms. One is the production of oxygen, two is the filter feeding of the resident biota, and three is the microbiome on the surface of the seagrass.
So here in Hawaii, in my personal experience diving and snorkeling, I don't see much in the way of seagrass, if any at all. In fact, I can't really think of ever seeing seagrass. So How about here in our Hawaii waters? What do we have as a substitute, or do we have different problems in Hawaii than what you see, say, on the west coast of the mainland?
Well, there certainly are some sites around that have small turtle grass beds. They're not as vast as some of the meadows that we had worked with before. But there are other vegetations in the marine environment that can do the same thing. For example, there are extensive mangroves on the Hilo side, and mangroves are known to have some of the same pathogen-fighting capabilities that seagrass do. Now, those mangroves are introduced species, and so there's certainly controversy about whether they should be removed or left. But my own sense is they provide very valuable ecosystem services in terms of wave barriers, as well as pathogen-fighting capabilities, as well as just providing nursery areas for small fish and invertebrates. So I'm not sure that they're bad, even though they're an introduced species.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. Not all introduced species end up being actually bad for our environment. Now, in your book, I think you address four groups of animals: starfish, abalone, salmon, and coral reefs. And I know that last time we talked, you did talk about starfish, but give us a sense as to what the situation is with starfish now.
Well, we've been closely monitoring the recovery or the ongoing epidemic of the starfish, and we did find another outbreak level this fall. So that epidemic does continue.
Where geographically are they located?
The epidemic of the starfish extended from Mexico all the way to Alaska and involved over 20 species of starfish. What we've been finding is that the epidemic does continue. Some of these species are quite susceptible and they're continuing to die. We had another sort of small pulse of stars dying this fall. Other species are seeming like the ochre star, which is, of course, the original keystone species described by the ecologist Bob Payne because of its capability to kind of control the balance of nature on the intertidal, are starting to come back. So we're seeing some hopeful signs in that most dominant of intertidal stars. But there are other species. The sunflower star was the most susceptible in the original outbreak, and it has been hammered along its entire range from Mexico all the way to northern Alaska. We're very concerned about this because the sunflower star is gigantic. It's the biggest and the fastest of the deeper water stars. It's over 4 feet across, well, the adults are, and it eats a lot of different things. In particular, it can eat baby sea urchins. And what we've been finding is not only is the sunflower star essentially gone for much of its range, but there have been big outbreaks of sea urchins that are increasing with their predator gone. And unfortunately, they're mowing down kelp beds and creating what we call urchin barrens, which are areas where no kelp grows, and thus it's impacting fisheries.
Does kelp in the ocean act a little bit like seagrass? Does it provide some of the benefits that you spoke of?
That's absolutely right, Sherry. Although we haven't measured this, in fact, I don't know that anybody's measured it, potentially kelp beds should provide a lot of the ecosystem services that seagrass beds do, filtering pathogens, creating areas where there are filter feeders that remove pathogens, and of course, generating a lot of oxygen.
You also mentioned abalone. Tell us what's going on with the abalone. When I was, I'd say in my 20s living in California, abalone was such a wonderful delicacy. People would go out and pick abalone, and that would be just about the best thing to eat. So what's going on with the abalone?
Well, one of the wonderful things about the California coast is that it has such a wide diversity of abalone. There are 11 species there. It's one of the most diverse zones in the world for abalone. And yet they've, again, been really decimated by not just harvesting. And you're right, they have been certainly over-harvested, but they've also been very affected by a disease. It's a rickettsial bacterium. Again, it's a multi-host pathogen, so it affects 6 or 7 of those abalone species and is driving some of them basically to extinction. The white abalone is already on the endangered species list, and there's concern there's not much that can be done to recover that species. The black abalone has been added to the endangered species list. There's discussions about adding the pinto abalone. So this is a group of animals that's been highly endangered by both harvesting and a temperature-sensitive disease.
Aloha. A brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, the very final one. I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer since December 5th, 2004. A huge thank you to Tom Trolin, Dan Deeb, John Weller, the whole team at Mahalo Broadcasting and Mahalo Multimedia that has let me do this program for, lo, these almost 15 years. I've had a great time, and I've mostly appreciated the feedback I've gotten from you, the listeners. Thank you so much. And thanks to the many informative guests. And thank you to Regency at Huala Live for sponsorship. Just so you know, I'm not disappearing. I'll still moderate forums, and I'm still reporting news for Hawaii Public Radio from the Big Island. Today, in our final interview, we're talking with Dr. Drew Harvell of Cornell University about the health of our oceans, and we'll follow this talk with a short discussion with Frank Truesdale, Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist, about a brand new lava map they've just put out. Let's get back to our discussion with Dr. Drew Harvell. I heard you speak this year at the Waimea Ocean Film Fest, and you mentioned abalone as both a food source, which I'm into, even though I hardly ever see abalone anymore, but also pharmaceuticals. I was unaware that abalone was considered important to the pharmaceutical industry. Tell us what you know about that.
There are so many interesting natural products that come from organisms in the ocean, and abalone blood is a really cool example. This is work that was done in Australia, and workers that were harvesting abalone started noticing that their warts on their hands and herpes virus wounds were disappearing from handling the abalone. And so scientists looked into the actual blood of the abalone and found that it has a very potent antiviral agent that's active against the herpes virus.
Wow. You know, we grow abalone, I think we still do, out at the Natural Energy Lab, and I think it's primarily as a food source, but how interesting. And I wonder if the College of Pharmacy here on the Big Island is doing any experiments at all with abalone, because that is pretty interesting. And I always get thrilled when there's something that looks to be a fairly natural solution to a problem.
Yeah, I think it's super exciting, and I really don't know whether the abalone that are grown here would also have that same antiviral agent in its blood, but certainly worth investigating. I mean, these kinds of discoveries, in addition to maybe, you know, oh, wouldn't it be cool if it was actually marketable, but they also lead us in important directions in developing new pharmaceuticals, even if we don't ever use the abalone blood ourselves.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me when the College of Pharmacy was founded and I interviewed the founding dean, John Pizzuto, he said one of the reasons he wanted the College of Pharmacy here on the Big Island was the proximity to so many natural resources, both on the land and in the ocean, because of exactly what you said, that there's so many possibilities for solutions, for pharmaceuticals, for things that can help with human disease. Actually, I want to digress and ask you about that. We're talking about diseases in the ocean. You're mentioning starfish and abalone and salmon and coral reefs. Can these diseases transfer themselves to humans? When we go diving or swimming in the ocean, are we at risk?
Well, the examples that I talk about are not things that can be transferred to humans, but there are examples of viruses in marine mammals that humans can share with them. So, for example, it seems like it went the other way, that perhaps a strain of the human flu virus was detected in whales. And so that's almost, well, that's pretty sad to me to think about human diseases getting down into the ocean. But, of course, there is a danger if these can be shared. And certainly there are bacteria, Vibrio bacteria, that are concentrated by bivalves, like oysters and mussels and clams, that can be pathogenic and really can kill and sicken humans.
Is that why at certain times of the year, I seem to remember in months that have R, you're not supposed to eat oysters? And I didn't know if that was an old wives' tale.
No, what it most likely is called a harmful algal bloom, which is a marine phytoplankton-like organism that makes really potent toxins that can kill people, causing paralytic shellfish poisoning. So that's not typically an actual infectious disease. It's a toxin that's in the water.
What about salmon? You mentioned salmon as one of the species you were looking at.
The success of farming salmon worldwide has been very impressive because Atlantic salmon have very fast growth rates and they're really amenable to being farmed, and that's been quite successful. But along with the success of these large salmon farms has been, of course, the outbreaks of salmon viruses. And so over the last 15 years, there's been rather a huge global pandemic of infectious salmon anemia that spread from regions in Norway to Chile to Maine in the farmed salmon. Salmon are also a group of, even the wild salmon are a group of organisms that under warming conditions are experiencing more disease. So there's quite a lot to be known about salmon viruses and diseases of salmon. And it's pretty important to make progress in order to be able to more effectively farm and harvest salmon from the sea.
I know we've talked a little bit about coral reefs, particularly in relationship to the Big Island, but I know that coral reefs are one of the areas of study mentioned in your book, Ocean Outbreak. Anything you'd like to add about coral reefs that we should understand?
Well, of course, everybody here on the Big Island knows that coral reefs are, in a sense, a foundation habitat. They create habitat for a lot of other biological diversity, and so they're ecologically just so very important. And then, sadly, the last few years, we've had horrendous bleaching events, which is incursions of warm water that have caused massive coral mortality just from direct heat stress around the world, but particularly in Australia. But what's less well known is that following those big bleaching events are often outbreaks of infectious disease. Because when corals are stressed by the heat, they lose their symbiotic algae that provides a lot of nutrition and also strength against or resistance against opportunistic diseases. So there's been quite an increase in levels of coral disease in the last few years, as well as bleaching. And those diseases, the infectious diseases of coral, are lethal. So a coral can recover from a bleaching event. It can recover its symbiotic algae, but they don't recover from a lethal infectious disease. All the tissue dies and the coral's dead.
You're not exactly a bluebird of happiness, Dr. Drew Harvell, even though I love speaking with you. What are solutions to these problems? You know, you mentioned in your book, Ocean Outbreak, that there are these four major infectious disease potentials. And you make it sound, though, like there's a lot of other potential disease in the ocean. What do we do as individuals to help address this?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, Sherry, because you're right. It is easy for this to be a gloom and doom story, but it's not. There are a lot of tools we have at our disposal if we develop the will to fight back against infectious disease in the ocean and work a little harder. And I've already talked about the value of ecosystem services of a lot of our natural marine habitats. Corals are healthier inside marine protected areas. They have fewer infectious diseases. Corals are healthier adjacent to and inside eelgrass or seagrass beds. Other organisms also are healthier adjacent to some of those natural ecosystems that have natural pathogen fighting capabilities, natural pathogen fighting superpowers. And I think what we need to do is focus more on those natural pathogen fighting capabilities that we have in our ocean and put those to work. A really interesting line of research was started probably 15 years ago by colleagues in Israel looking at phage therapy, for example.
What's that?
Phage therapy is when we actually find a virus that can kill pathogenic bacteria. And it might surprise you, but we use this, for example, at Cornell. There's a really interesting study looking at the actions of some of these phages in killing infections in dairy cows, ones that are very intractable to antibiotics, such as digestive system infections, or actually it's uterine infections in cows. So my colleague in Israel went out and isolated thousands and thousands of viruses until he found just the couple of them that would actually selectively kill some of the coral pathogens. And he was even able to show that by adding these to aquaria with sick corals, that the phages battled back the coral disease and made the corals healthier. So this is not something we're ready to roll out as an immediate management tool, but it just shows you that there's some really important frontiers that we can be investigating that are going to help with the health, both in our oceans, and that will also have spin-offs for human health as well.
The virus you mentioned developed by your colleague in Israel, is that something that you are thinking could ultimately be introduced safely into an ocean environment to assist the coral without somehow creating some other bad impact?
Well, I think we need to do an awful lot more work before we're ready to start introducing those kinds of biocontrol agents to the ocean, so I absolutely would not advocate that. But I do think that what we learn as researchers about how natural viruses exist in the ocean that can control some of these bacteria is vital, perhaps in future development of either phage therapies or vaccines against some of these diseases.
Dr. Harvell, I know that you've encountered plastics in the ocean in connection with your work. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, one more thing that we've seen from our work in Indonesia is a negative effect of plastics. We were doing work on plastics and their effect on coral health and found that when corals are in contact with plastic, they have an 80% greater chance of having an infectious disease. We think this is because the plastics not only cut into the living skin of the coral and provide an entryway for pathogens, but also the plastics convey bacterial pathogens themselves. And so it's kind of a double whammy on the corals. Now, of course, all we studied were the corals, but given what we found about the level of infections conveyed to corals from plastics, we wonder about what other marine organisms are also suffering increased levels of disease from contact with plastics. So it's one more thing we can do. Cutting back plastics in the ocean is going to make for a healthier sea.
Dr. Drew Harvell, before we say aloha, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Sherry, I think we've really covered the main priorities that I've been thinking about and that I've covered in this book. I guess, you know, the only thing I would think to add is one of the topics in this book is really about the scientists themselves, both myself and my students, and kind of both the challenges and the adventures that we've experienced as we've ended up really traveling around the globe to deal with these different outbreaks as they happen. They can be like lightning strikes, just blasting out of nowhere and often unseen at the start until they turn into a full-blown epidemic that we need to deal with, investigate, and try to isolate the causative agent. So it's a combination of a lot of adventure and then a lot of heartbreak, too, in watching some of these organisms die and seeing the loss of function in our biological communities. Basically, the balance of nature is so easily upset by these outbreaks. So I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say, and I loved the chance to talk with you and really appreciate you having me on. Mahalo.
Dr. Drew Harvell, where can people buy the book Ocean Outbreak?
People can buy the book, Ocean Outbreak, from my publisher, University of California Press, and of course, from Amazon.
Thank you so much, Dr. Drew Harvell. Aloha.
Aloha, Sherry.
And that was my discussion with Dr. Drew Harvell of Cornell University. And now, a bonus. Last Thursday, I met with Frank Truesdale, a geologist with Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. HVO recently added a map to their website that shows the thickness of the brand new lava flow, and it's preliminary, but super interesting. I only have time to include an excerpt of my conversation with Frank. I'm going to post the whole conversation at our podcast site, lava1053.com and koacountry1077.com. You may find the map if you Google Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, go to Multimedia, and then to Maps. So, Frank, Hawaiian Volcano Observatory on their website put out a new map. It's an interesting map for those of us who spend a lot of time looking at your maps. This one deals a lot with the lava flow thickness of the new Kilauea lava flow that happened during the summer of 2018. Talk about this, because I don't think most of us have seen a map on your website that deals with the thickness of the lava. So just tell us more about it.
This map is a way to show the thickness of all the lava flows that occurred during the summer. It's a preliminary map, and what we've done is we're comparing the thickness of the current flows to the topography before the flows, and we basically take the new additional flows and subtract it from the previous topography, and what you end up with is the thickness of the lava flow field. So some of the obvious things you can see is down by the coast, where the topography is relatively flat, the flows have thickened and overplated itself several times over. And so that's where the greatest thickness is, where the slopes are steeper. It's not so thick, and that's because the lava will drain away, just like liquid will drain away from highs and pond in lows is kind of what this map is showing.
What is the thickest lava that you were able to measure?
Well, offshore in the submarine environment, we have preliminary thicknesses up to about 250 meters thick.
Wow, that's pretty thick.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why it's so thick is the water will more quickly congeal the lava, and so won't flow away or drain, and then additional flows will just stack up on it and make the flows relatively thick. Whereas on land, if there's a capability for the lava to pond or spread out, then that will ultimately thin the lava flows.
Okay, so the map that you posted on the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory website, are parts of this map in the water then? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, the parts that are shown, if you go to the website and look at it, that are the reddest, those are mostly offshore.
Wow, I mean, that's so fascinating. So the question is, how did you measure all this lava? How did you measure the thickness, both on land and underwater?
Okay, so the on land portion was measured using UAVs. UAV was a new technology that we had.
And is that a UAV as a drone?
Well, people are sensitive about the term drone, but for the common person, yes. Unmanned aerial systems. So what we've done is we've flown many, many different missions, and by using stereo pairs, you can actually make a three-dimensional model. So if you look at this flow field, we're talking about many thousands of photographs to compile such a map. In the offshore area, they actually brought out a bathymetric surveyor. So it floats on the top of the water, and then it sends signal down, and then the returns are measured, and essentially what you're getting is the depth through the flows. So there were prior surveys that looked at this coast, and so we can also difference the prior survey to the new data, and we can then get the thickness.
So, am I right that we have not typically seen maps on the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory website that detail thickness, or is that just my bad memory?
I think thickness maps have been presented, but typically in official publications. You got to realize we're in a new realm where everything is the web, and prior times the web didn't exist, and everybody's very hungry for data, and so in this case, we were able to compile the information and put it out so people have a general idea of the thickness of the lava flows. And I have to emphasize, this is preliminary.
Okay, now Frank, why is it preliminary?
The reason why it's preliminary is that we have to go back and check what we use to correct the flows. So we have to have what we call data points on the ground that are surveyed in, and then we take this model that we make and anchor them to those data points. And then sometimes there are areas in which the overlap isn't sufficient and we have to make corrections. We have to make geometric corrections. And we also have to go back and look at the prior data and make sure that we're also differencing an area where we're looking at the bare ground and not maybe the tops of trees.
There is one segment on this new map that is in black, and the note with it says that the data is still being collected. Why is there a segment of this map that apparently has not been fully mapped yet?
There's two reasons why the data has not been collected. One is this area in black was under the plume, and you don't want to fly your UAVs in those areas. And the second is, once the flow field developed to the configuration that it is in, and so when you're stationing your drones on the so-called accessible roadways, some of these distances are much further than the drones can actually fly and retrieve data and then return back safely.
And that was an excerpt from my discussion with Frank Truesdale, Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist. HVO is working to get a plane to do a more comprehensive look and to revise this preliminary map. But you may find the map at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory website. And you may hear the whole discussion with Frank at the podcast sites lava1053.com and koacountry1077.com to hear how scientists and planners will use these maps. This is Island Issues, the very final one, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. Thank you so much for listening for the last 14 plus years. Thank you to Lava 105 and Koa Country for letting me host this show. If you'd like to reach me personally, you may email me at sherrybracken@gmail.com. Whether or not I remind you every Sunday morning, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@lava105.com. Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.